rule that creates a strict distinction between those who have been arrested pursuant to a warrant and those arrested without a warrant provides an incentive to forego the warrant requirement. We know that there's a significant strategic advantage to not telling a person in the interrogation room the reasons that they have been charged and to withhold the specific charges. We see that in this case, how the interrogation unfolded was the direct result of defendant's ignorance of the charges. He was picked up at his parole office, so therefore it's creating an impression that this was something that was associated with parole. He's brought to the Asbury Park Police Station. He does ask twice, why am I being arrested? He's first told that we're gonna get to the details once we get to the station. And then on the recording, he says, I'm under arrest, right? And they say yes, that we'll get to the details later on. They don't get to the details until about halfway through the interrogation, because the first third of the interrogation is about parole and his life, getting these like seemingly innocuous details that they then use later at the latter half to challenge his denials about where he's been and who he knows and his basis of knowledge about the shooting. And so this interrogation could have only unfolded this way because he was ignorant of the charges. And I'm not suggesting bad faith or anything like that, but we do know that the police officers in this case had more than ample cause, probable cause to file a complaint warrant. We know that when they went to the hospital to interview the witness, they already had a sufficient basis to suspect defendant in this, and then they get this unequivocal identification from the witness. And what follows next is not application for a complaint warrant. What follows next is trying to track him down at his parole officer's office. And I believe there was one of the police officers that testified that actually it was difficult to get in touch with his parole officer. And so this was clearly an attempt to find him in a public place, to arrest him, and that decision led to his complete ignorance, and that had an impact in how this interrogation unfolded. I think that had he known at the outset that this was for attempted murder, they wouldn't have been able to hide the ball until way into the interrogation.
Ms. Watson, when we left off, you had pointed to the limits in the opinion and the footnotes about the breadth of the appellate division's ruling, where it says it would apply to cases developed through investigation, but not a situation, for example, where an officer actually observes a crime and then makes an arrest. What's the principled reason for that distinction? In both cases, an officer has probable cause. In one, he or she has literally seen the crime. Why should a defendant only be advised in one case and not the other? What's the principled reason there?
In an ideal world, a defendant would always be advised of the reasons for his arrest once the police officers have made a decision, because presumably they do know the charges. I think the appellate division's limitation is to address the issues about administrability. So we know that after an investigation, there's just been more time to deliberate. There's probably been conferencing with the prosecutor's office. And under those circumstances, we can be more confident in the charges that they're telling the defendant in the interrogation room. And because I am Mr. Sims' counsel, I'm not asking for an expansion of the appellate division's opinion, but I do think the overlapping reason, there's some overlapping reasoning that the person who is arrested based on probable cause that unfolds in front of the police officers.
So we know that some investigations move at a very rapid pace.
Yes.
Should administrability factor in for those as well?
I do not think so. That can't be the prevailing concern, administrability. Like the critical concern here is whether the defendant has the information to exercise his rights knowingly and intelligently. This is just simply an attempt to accommodate that. I think it's also an attempt to incentivize a warrant, because even if an investigation is unfolding rapidly, once a police officer has made the probable cause assessment and that they can arrest this person, then there's also the opportunity to have applied for a warrant, and the failure to do so should be to the detriment of the defendant.
As you would see this rule being applied? Should officers delay an interview until they've had an opportunity to speak with a prosecutor in places where that's required?
I think it's if it's feasible, that would be the better practice. I'm not suggesting that they need to change the order of the interrogation. I only provided that information to suggest that there are opportunities for conferring before there is an interrogation. And the rule that requires that you reach out to the prosecutor as soon as possible after there's a warrantless arrest, I don't know if that's happening before or after the interrogation. I think conceivably a better practice is to confer with the prosecutor before the interrogation, but I don't think that's a critical component of this rule.
I'm trying to figure out your principled position as the Chief Justice was probing. Police officer sees a hand-to-hand transaction, arrests a person, and now wants to interrogate the person. If you're using the Reed AGD rationale, it's critical information. Like why have I been arrested? And is it your position that, well, that doesn't count because there wasn't sufficient time to consult with the prosecutor or to get a warrant? Are you carving out those cases?
Well, this is the appellate division's decision. I think the information is equally indispensable to every criminal defendant who has been arrested, because presumably the police officers do know the crimes because they've made an arrest and they've made an assessment of probable cause. I'm just saying that when it's an investigation, when it's an arrest following an investigation, then perhaps like that would reduce the litigation about sort of the variance between the charges that the defendant is told and the charges that are ultimately approved.
From a standpoint of what the rationale underlying this rule is, I don't see these limits holding. I see the bright line rule, if there's an extension, extending even beyond. And that's why I'm asking you about this, to try to get a sense of what the true scope of the rule would be from a logical standpoint.
I am not asking for an expansion. I'm not asking for an expansion of the appellate division's decision because I don't have a case that suggests that that presents those facts. I wholeheartedly agree that when police have arrested based on probable cause, that person should also be advised of the reason for the arrest, but there isn't briefing on that, and we haven't gone beyond those facts in this case.
Is there, you say, you mentioned critical information a number of times, the cases mention it, Justice Alvin's questioned about it. Isn't a determination as to what is critical information to a defendant a subjective question, and this is an objective test?
No, AGD and Vincenti said that it's a objectively critical information, the charges.
Okay, that's not, but the determination as to what is critical information as to a defendant. For example, we don't have charges yet. We just have in the police officer's mind what the reason or rationale for the arrest is. There may be many other charges. Maybe what is or is not critical information to the defendant, it's going to be determined. I presume it's got to be determined on a case-by-case basis rather than a bright line, because if it's a bright line, whether it's critical or not doesn't matter.
Well, I think our case law about the critical information, simply we've made a value judgment that certain information is critical. In Reed, for example, the information about your attorney waiting to confer with you may be more critical to some defendants than not, but across the board, we've just determined that this information is so essential that we're going to deliver it to every defendant. And we don't make the assessment about whether it's more important to this defendant or that defendant. We've just decided as a matter of law, it's indispensable.
But we don't know, I guess what I'm getting at is, we don't know what that information is going to have to be. It's going to depend case by case because Justice Patterson's example, the chief's example, they may be arresting him based on information they have leading them to believe they have probable cause to arrest him on a particular charge, But it turns out that kidnapping, where they haven't found the victim yet, turns out to be a murder. Or the simple assault, because they thought it was a fight, turns out to be a murder. So what is the critical information is going to depend on, maybe it's not, because it's a bright line rule, but is that bright line what he's charged with, or what he's arrested for, or what he's ultimately charged with? And they could be two different things as to what is. I'm sure a defendant would like to know if it's murder or simple assault. I'm sure a defendant would like to know if it's theft or armed robbery. So what is the determination? What is the critical information? What the officer has in his head at the time of the arrest, or what happens down the road?
The critical information is the probable cause that the officer has to arrest the defendant at that moment, not what's in his head, because probable cause is an objective determination.
So that, it won't matter. So we're not going to get motions in every case where the ultimate charges are not what the officer told the defendant he was arresting them for. We're not going to get a motion in any of those cases.
Well, I think that that set of circumstances can easily play out even when there have been complaint charges. There may be, the complaint may have been amended after the officer tells the defendant, here are the charges against you.
That's not the standard. I get you, but that's not the standard. This court said that's not the standard. The standard is when you've been charged, the defendant has to know. Whatever happens thereafter, happens thereafter. When you've been charged, the defendant has to know what he's been charged with.
I only answered that way to demonstrate that AGD and Vincenti also invites a little bit of uncertainty, in the sense that a defendant can also always litigate a suppression motion and say, well, the charges that you told me, they were misleading, because at the time the charges were filed, you knew this additional information and the charges didn't reflect that.
Doesn't matter. AGD's answer. It's a bright line rule.
I understand that, but I'm saying wouldn't prevent that issue from being raised at a suppression hearing. So what the defendant is asking for at this moment is to just know the reason for his arrest, the charges that support his arrest.
Your comparison to other cases makes absolutely no sense, because I guess I could raise it in my motion that today it's nighttime right now, but it's not nighttime. There are bright line rules that have been established in very specific cases under very specific circumstances. But this would literally could be challenged in each and every arrest where a charging document has not been issued by a judge. Could it not legitimately be raised, and will be, I can guarantee you, in every single case, now, unlike the other cases you've cited?
Conceivably, it could be raised in many cases. I don't know how these are going to be litigated, but the answer comes down to, was the defendant informed of the essence of the charges against him? And it may be a pretty straightforward analysis. The judge will say, well, this is what the police officers knew, and they accurately reflected the essence of the charges when they told you, and so we're not going to suppress your statement. I guess I'm concerned about sort of, we've already decided that this information is indispensable to a certain class of defendants, and the difference between these defendants is nothing that they did. It's the police officers deciding not to file a complaint warrant. So
you
a defendant doesn't
already decided. What do you mean?
I mean, AGD and Vincenti has already said that this is important to someone.
That specific information has to be disclosed. Charging document. Your attorney's outside the door.
Yes,
we know that.
A defendant who is arrested without a warrant is very similarly situated, but for the formality of the charges being filed, which has to be filed immediately. So I'm suggesting that person, the jeopardy that he's facing, the forces of the state that are arrayed against him, is very similar to the defendant who the defendants in AGD and Vincenti. And if we've already decided that it's indispensable, it means that it's critically important to defendants like Mr. Sims. In Reed, in pronouncing the rule that departed from the United States Supreme Court precedent, the dissent had a parade of hypotheticals that may occur, and all of the ways in which this new rule would have been litigated and muddied the waters. And the court said that, like, the rule is can be easily administered because you've decided the rule in this case, there is an arrest that's based on probable cause. It has to be tied to an offense. A defendant is simply asking for the essence of the charges that he's facing at that moment. And because we've already decided that's critically important, and because the distinction here is the one that's solely within the hands of the police officer, there's no reason to treat this class of defendants differently.
Thank you, Ms. Watson.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Connor.
May it please the court. Following up on the last comment, the parade of horribles set forth by the state is the same that was raised in O'Neill, in Reed, in ADGD, and in Vicente. And it hasn't happened. And I suggest to you that this case is not that hard, that this idea that there's going to be endless litigation over this is just not true. The police officer, by statute, by law, has to have probable cause that an offense, that a crime has been committed by this defendant in order to effectuate that arrest. He cannot arrest the person because he's a bad guy. He can't arrest him because he doesn't like him. He can't arrest him because maybe he committed a crime, and I'll figure it out after I talk to the prosecutor. That's not the law. And what this court should not countenance is to allow the state, as they've admitted, to manipulate the charging process to get around a demand from this court that they provide critical information to get people to waive the Miranda warnings. And that's what they're doing. They've admitted that. The question here is, if you want to know when to draw that line, I suggest to you that it's relatively straightforward. The officer has to know why he has arrested that person. He has to know what offense he has committed or has probable cause to believe. And the time box should be at the time when they go to administer the Miranda warnings. At that moment in time, it is not hard for the officer to say, we have arrested you for this. And now we're going to ask you to waive your Miranda warnings. We're going to provide.
In some cases, that's certainly easy to determine. Is it your position that's always true?
Yes. How can the officer not know why he's arrested someone? How is that possible? Because if that's true...
You don't have to raise your voice.
I'm sorry. I'm a little excited after listening to this for the last 2 hours, Judge. How is that never not possible?
So as to administering and implementing a rule like this, you heard the hypotheticals that were posed, the kidnapping, murder, and others. Wouldn't you file and insist on a hearing to determine what the officer knew at that moment in time?
I think, Your Honor, that will only become realistic if the officers are not being truthful. The issue is, if they have probable cause to arrest someone for kidnapping, already a serious offense, okay, so we already have the forces of the state, the veil coming down on you, that's a serious offense. But they don't have probable cause because they haven't found the body, they don't have someone who says, yeah, we know we killed them, or who it is. That is reasonable for the officer to say, yes, I have probable cause to arrest you for kidnapping, and then to continue with their questioning. And perhaps during the course of that interrogation, the guy says, yes, I killed her. And then they can go to the prosecutor and file other charges. That happens all the time, and that's not an issue. The only times where I think you're going to get litigation is where either the police officer lies and says, I'm arresting you for murder when it's, you know, a burglary, or the officer says, I'm arresting you for a parole violation, and it's a murder when you're at those extremes.
That's not an issue.
I'm sorry?
Did you just say that's not an issue?
I don't think it's a real issue. It's a fake issue, Judge.
So where that defendant is picked up and says, I picked you up for kidnapping, and he gives a statement, and a day later they find the body of the kidnapped victim, which they were concerned about and were thinking about, and he's charged with that murder. That motion's not going to be filed by you as defense counsel to suppress that statement?
Judge, motions are filed for all sorts of things, as you said before. I could file a motion at night.
That's right? Not but what I asked.
I'll finish.
That's not what I asked.
I'm trying to get there, Judge.
Please do.
The issue is, at the point of time when the interrogation took place, the officer will know what he has probable cause to arrest the person for.
That's
at that time.
That's what I asked.
Then I apologize, and I ask you to...
All right, let me ask you again.
I apologize.
I'll speak slowly. A person gets arrested for kidnapping. They interview him and tell him, we arrest you for taking so-and-so. He gets arrested. He makes statements. He gets charged, and some incriminating. He gets charged 3 days, 3 hours, 2 hours later with kidnapping and murder because they find the body of the person they thought was kidnapped. You're telling me he's now charged with kidnapping and murder, or maybe just murder, God only knows. You're not going to file that motion that says, wait a minute, you were investigating him for murder, and you only told him this, and that was just to get him talking and saying incriminating things. You're not going to file that motion?
Wouldn't I file the same motion under the totality of the circumstances argument, Your Honor? Because I'm going to say, make the same argument saying, look, it's critical information. I should have had it. They withheld it to me. You're not getting away from that by saying totality of the circumstances. That is an amorphous standard that allows you to bring up anything. So I don't think it's going to lead to the parade of horribles that the state has proposed to you.
Are you asking for a totality of circumstances analysis?
No, Your Honor. I'm arguing that you'll still have that motion, so that your idea that this is going to cause more litigation, I don't think is accurate.
What will that motion be based on?
Your Honor, I guess what we're saying is that if the court issues upholding Sims and says the officer or the interrogating officer has to advise the defendant at the time that they issue the Miranda warnings, you have been arrested for X, for kidnapping, and they do that. And then later on, during the course of the interrogation, the guy admits, oh, by the way, I not only kidnapped her, but I killed her.
My question was not about if we sustain Sims. Then that motion's definitely going to be filed. But if we don't sustain Sims, you were saying that motion's going to be filed anyway?
Well, yes, because under the totality of the circumstances, I could still make that motion and saying, look, they withheld critical information from me and didn't tell me when they had it, and they should have told me because I needed to know that before I had a knowing, voluntary.
But it's not the same motion, because the motion you would make in the situation that is in Justice Solomon's hypothetical is, I was told all they were looking at me for was a kidnapping. That was what I was told. I was arrested for kidnapping. And now I find out that what they were really going after me for was it was a murder. I mean, that's a much more sort of a bright line kind of motion than the totality motion that you're talking about.
Again, Your Honor, if the facts are the officer at the time he made the arrest had probable cause to arrest for kidnapping and not for murder, I don't see that is an issue that's going to go very far.
Counselor, if they're the same, why do you need Sims then? Because your argument so far to Justice Solomon, Justice Patterson, been that they're the same and you could do it anyway. So if they're the same, you could do it anyway, totality circumstances and Sims. Why do you need Sims?
Because we've seen, Your Honor, that the law enforcement will try and manipulate the charging decisions to get around what is a bright line rule and will make it easier.
But you're saying totality circumstances has the same effect as Sims. So why do you need Sims if you already have totality circumstances in your arsenal?
Because it does away with the idea that we're going to withhold critical information from the person who has the Fifth Amendment right, Your Honor.
I understand you said we've seen this manipulation. I had not heard that before. Is there a record? Have there been cases in which this has come up in the many matters that are presented each year?
The county prosecutor's office all but admitted it, Judge.
I heard what he said. I'm asking you, has there been litigation
that demonstrates
manipulation?
I think what you see here, Judge, in this case, is the officers had the information on the 13th, did not go get a complaint on the 13th, found out when Mr. Sims was going to be at his parole office on the 14th so they could arrange for a planned arrest, and went and did a warrantless arrest so that they could do the interrogation. They did not bring him to the police station right away to file a complaint. They brought him to a satellite office so they can interrogate him. I think you can infer from that set of facts, Your Honor, that the officers did manipulate the charging decisions in order to be able to interrogate this defendant without advising him of the charges.
I'm trying to see the difference between this situation and AGD. The police officers, given the hypothetical, can get a kidnapping complaint. And under that hypothetical, I guess I could still question the person about a potential murder of the body's missing. My question is, has the system been overwhelmed with motions? Has it been thrown into disarray?
Based on what I heard from the argument before from the Attorney General's office, it has not, Your Honor, and I agree with you. There is no qualitative or conceptual distinction between being arrested on the complaint and being arrested on a probable cause by an officer in terms of what could happen with whether the charges could be amended, whether they could be upgraded, whether they could be downgraded. That could happen in both circumstances, and I agree with Your Honor that they are the same.
Mr. O'Connor, do you stand by the limits in the opinion?
I don't think they're necessary, Judge. And here's why. For the same reason I said, at the time the officer makes the arrest, he or she, at that moment, must know what offense they are arresting the defendant for. And so I don't think that distinction on whether...
They must know the offense the second of the arrest. There's a shooting. There are people all in the area. Witnesses are making statements. And the officer arrests an individual and must know, ultimately, this is going to be an aggravated manslaughter.
No. That you added ultimately, Your Honor. That's not what I said. At the time he makes the arrest, he has to know at that moment what he's arresting. Those charges can change. We all agree, whether it's on a complaint, they can certainly change as the case proceeds. I don't think there's any disagreement on that. But at the moment he arrests the person, he or she has to know at that moment what he is arresting the person for. And that is the information that needs to be provided. We're not asking them to look into a crystal ball and say, you know, later on down the road, the prosecutor's going to decide they had this charge or the prosecutor is going to, downgrade that charge. That's not what's being asked. It's at the moment of the arrest, or I think more accurately, at the moment of the interrogation.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I have one question for you, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. O'Connor, under your position, does it make any difference whether the defendant asked, what am I being arrested for or not?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because I think that goes to the discussion we had earlier you can't put this right on him, the person who's been arrested, having enough fortitude to say, oh, what am I being arrested for? It's the same as saying, well, we didn't have to give Miranda because he had always had the right not to talk to us. So why do we have to give the warning? So I would say that the defendant or the arrestees asking or not asking why he's been arrested is of no import.
Thank you.
Your Honor, and I just I rest, if there's no questions about the Confrontation Clause, I rest on the argument in our papers on the Confrontation Clause. Thank you.
Mr. Otero, brief rebuttal.
I'm grateful for the court's time, but the state has no rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under